From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Chicago, in a crowded apartment building. A boy named Arshay Cooper was lying on his bed, staring at the ceiling, when the door opened. His mother walked in. In his memoir, Cooper recounts what happened next, and I'll quote him now. Quote, "Looking back at my mom, I can see her pupils floating in tears. She speaks, and my life is forever changed. Arshay, my father, your grandfather, raped and beat me when I was younger. Suddenly, the noise on the radio doesn't exist. My body shuts down, but my mind is on high alert. My head sweats. I feel as if my heart is pierced with the sword. I keep staring at this woman, my mother, staring right into her eyes. And I can see all her hurt and feel all her feelings. I don't know what she wants me to say. I ask myself, how many other families go through this? Is it normal for innocent young girls to be raped by their fathers? For God's sake, I'm only 15. Why is she telling me?" End quote. That is how Cooper's remarkable memoir begins, and it is, to say the least, the story of unlikely success for a number of reasons. Whatever you might expect to come next, you probably do not expect that young black males would be rescued, in a sense, by the affluent sport of crew. His book, Sugar Water, gives us a look inside a city we're hearing a lot about in the news, Chicago. It takes us inside life for a child who sees drug addiction and violence so often, and there are lessons for us in Rochester and really everywhere. Cooper is not only a practice rower, but he has coached at the Chicago Youth Rowing Club. He has spoken about struggle and success with everyone from public school students to President Bill Clinton. And today he is in Rochester. He's a guest of several organizations. He's telling his story. You can meet him. You can get the book. We'll tell you about all of those events coming up. But first, let me welcome Arshay Cooper to the program. It is an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Rochester.
Well, it's great to have you, Arshay. And let me just briefly let people know, because you've got a busy schedule here before you get back to, well, where's home for you now?
Home is New York City.
So you got a tight schedule here in Rochester. Today, 2:30 to 3:30 at the RIT Mosaic Center. He's part of the River Romance Festival this weekend, by the way. But today, 2:30 to 3:30 at RIT. What are you talking about art at RIT?
It's their diversity program. So we're talking a lot about just diversity and my story and the sportive crew.
Very good. And so that's 2:30 to 3:30 at RIT's Mosaic Center today. Also talking about the themes of changing the lives of urban youth through rowing tonight from 6 to about 7:15 at the Adams Street Rec Center in Rochester. This is free and open to the public. Starts at 6 o'clock tonight at the Adams Street Rec Center. He's going to be a guest of a number of organizations. The Youth Sports Foundation, the Genesee Waterway Center, the City of Rochester, the Rochester River School, and the Rochester River Foundation, all partnering to make sure he's here for that. So there's similar themes tonight, 6 o'clock tonight?
6 o'clock tonight.
All right. And then he's going to be out on Sunday at the Genesee Waterway Center, Genesee Valley Park, from about 9 to 2 or so, near the race's finish line under a big City of Rochester tent. What's going on Sunday?
Sunday, I'm going to do some erg demonstrations. Before I joined this sport, my first experience was some erg demonstrations. So I'm going to do the same for young people. I'm going to sign some books. I'm going to hang out and just tell my story, do some one-on-ones, hopefully with some young people, and have some fun.
Well, so you got a chance to meet him. The book will be there?
The book will be there.
And, you know, look, I'm somebody who promotes reading the books before seeing the movies, but there's a movie coming as well?
Yeah, there's a movie coming out in 2018. The producer, Mark Lispy, he did Eddie Murphy, a lot of Eddie Murphy movies. His very first movie was Coming to America that he executive produced. And he read the book and he wanted to be on board right away. He believed that the country needs a story like this, the story of hope, the story of diversity, and the story of crew. And so I'm excited about that. And we're working on the screenplay and trying to keep things, true and to the book.
Sure. And I'm already curious to know if the opening scene of the movie will be the opening scene of the book. But let me just ask you why you decided to start there. I mentioned at the start of the hour here that you were 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother came to you. And before we even kind of get back to that description, you kind of lead into that by saying you knew something was up because there was a look in her eyes. You could tell?
Yeah, I can tell. Just the tears in her eyes, the way she was shaking, she was vibrating. And the music that was playing, usually in our household when sad music is playing, when slow music's playing, there's something wrong. And at that point, I knew.
Listen to this, by the way. I'm going to go back here and see if I've got... Okay. Yeah, because you did... Okay, so you say, my mother has a look in her eyes that I have never seen. In my head, all I can think is, who died?
Who died? Yes. We don't get that look often, but the couple times we did, someone passed away. And when she had that look, I was like, who died? It was, I can remember it, you know, leading up to that moment, I just felt the energy in the household that something was wrong. I'm about to hear something. And, some people can recognize that and feel that energy. When someone comes in the house, you just know someone, especially if it's your mother, someone you grew up with, that something's about to be said that's going to end my world, you know? And that's how I felt at 15.
At 15 years old, and that's a lot to put on you, but she wanted you to know. She told you she thought you should know. Then she told your brother, and there's a, you guys seem to react a little differently, or how would you describe the way this hits you? Let me put it that way.
I knew there was family issues. The moment I explained that, my mom told me that story. For me, it made sense. It in my head also reflect on when my grandfather would, when he was drunk and he would come in the house and he would hit on my grandmother and beat on my grandmother. And being young, I didn't understand why, even as adults, my uncles and aunts were somehow afraid of this man, you know, my grandfather. And so really it was the memories of him. He was, he died already, but the memories came back of, and I don't remember good ones, you know? And so it just confirmed some things.
Let our listeners know what childhood was like for you. I mean, you start the book at 15, but give me a sense of your childhood.
Childhood is, we grew up on the west side of Chicago, very, very poor. And my mother was a drug addict before she told me this story. And she was a drug addict. And I've never said the word dad a day of my life.
Do you know your father?
I met him a few times.
Okay.
My brothers were in gangs. My uncle was a gang leader. Didn't have many friends. It was one day I thought they were my friend. Next day they talked about me behind my back, about my mother being a drug addict. There was no food in the house. She would come home every couple of days, and thank God my grandmother was there. And that affected me a lot. I show up at school, and the teachers thought I had a problem because I wouldn't say anything, or I wouldn't do my homework. Or, for me, my idea was like, how can I learn about math or Christopher Columbus when I think my brother's gonna die in the street, or there's no food at home, or is my mama gonna OD like the rest of the kids' mother on the block? So I couldn't concentrate in school, and there was nothing wrong with me. I just couldn't think about these things. And so that was every day for me. That was every day. And one thing I talk about in the book, the one thing that really kind of gave me hope was certain TV shows like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and A Different World
and
Family Matters. Yeah. You don't have to be this way if you have brown skin. You don't have to live this way, that, somehow things can change, And
just a sort of a sidetrack, but what I was struck by in your description of the way Fresh Prince of Bel-Air impacts you, we're in this sort of weird media culture now where if Idris Elba is going to be James Bond, people freak out. Like, James Bond can't be black? Come on, man. And I'm like, James Bond's not even a real guy. Everybody just calm it down, right? But everybody freaks out if there's over-representation.
Yeah.
Or that's supposed to be a white role. It's like we have this entitlement to it. But what you are describing in the book is this idea that when you saw people who look like you, mm-hmm. even in a fictional world with a laugh track, mm-hmm. it gave you hope.
Gave me hope. I mean, it doesn't matter, if Thor was white or black, at a young kid, I still want to be Thor. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter, but just because they looked like me and I didn't, I watched the Wonder Years and all those shows and those were great. But, to watch black kids in college and look at my neighborhood, there was no black kids in college. It really had an impact on my life.
You also talked about the fact that when the conversation about the future happened, it's much more likely to be what gang you're going to join as opposed to what college you're going to.
Yeah. So, you show up at school and, it's not like I would go to California and you see the Crips and Bloods in one community, the Crips in one community, the Bloods in another community. Every couple blocks, there's a different gang. And all those gangs go to one school. And you have these guys say, hey, are you going to be a vice lord? Are you going to be a new breed? Are you going to be a GD? And that's how you get protection, and you want that protection, you know? And so for me, I was like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to be a part of the Breeze because they dress like this and look like this, but maybe a Vice Lord because they help you out with this. You know what I mean? They even give turkeys in the neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. And so for everyone, that was kind of an option. Everyone, they felt like that was their only choice. You know what I mean?
When you talked about your own mother sharing her story of being raped, mm-hmm. and you trying to, as a 15-year-old, process that. I mean, that's a lot for anybody, let alone a 15-year-old. And then I think the question of how that impacts you when you take that with you to school, and when you are dealing with not being able to sort of concentrate on subjects. There's such a risk, I think, of you could drop out, right? You mm-hmm. could join a gang. You don't have to. Arshay, what's the lesson for how we discipline, how we deal with students who are not doing their homework assignments, who are failing tests, but we know that at home there may be trauma? Because the teachers, I think, are in a very hard spot where, you know, if you don't do a homework assignment, if you don't do well on a test, you know, they feel like they have to mark some way that you're not progressing academically, but penalize you too hard, you drop out, and that's even worse for you. Mm-hmm. So in your own experience then, what are some of the lessons that you think, especially as you've gotten older, that we can apply, not just in Chicago, but in Rochester, in urban centers especially, where there's poverty and trauma, and kids, I think, probably would love to have a more stable life, but they don't. And homework and reading and test taking can't always be priority one.
Well, I'm going to tell you a quick story. This was in the spring, this past spring, I was speaking at Beginning with Children's Public School in Brooklyn. And in the middle of my speech talking about my mother, this kid started punching the desk. And I'm looking at him. And he started punching the desk. And then another teacher was like, you know, I ain't gonna say his name, you have to leave. And I said, no. Let him stay. Because he had a look in his eyes that was very familiar. I remember that look. That was me. And he started saying, my mom's so stupid. My mom's so stupid. Mm. And I said, let's talk about it. And the other kids were really uncomfortable. I said, let's talk about it. I'm here to share my story. And he said, my mother had died 2 weeks ago. They lived in the Marcy Projects. And my stepdad told her to move, but she wouldn't. And she was killed. And another kid raised his hand. He told a story about his cousin. And I sat there. And I explained my story, and I gave these cool metaphors about, you know, just being young and dealing with pain and trauma and that kind of thing. But I couldn't leave that school just with a speech. Every single Friday for the rest of that school year, I was with them. I decided to stay with them and do icebreaker games. And we all read my book, and we talk about the poetry in my book. And, you know, but we can't kick him out the classroom. What would happen if they just kicked him out the classroom without telling his story and someone made fun of him that day? You know, he was hurting. So I think the key really is to be patient, just like Ken did with me. It's, you know, just being there for you. Let's join a community center. Let's go to another school and do some erg races. It's really just being patient with them and really getting to the bottom of what's going on in their lives and talking with them. You know, I talk about in the book, not just talking at people, or not just trying to get a withdrawal from kids, but really making a deposit. When you make a positive deposit in their lives, that's when you get a withdrawal, you know? And a lot of times we had teachers just talked at us, and we never told those teachers our stories, but those who made a deposit, they got a positive withdrawal every time.
I kind of want you to go to every school, you know, because so many students who, as you say, you see yourself in them, mm-hmm. they just have to, we have to find a way to let them know that they are loved and that they are valued, because it would be easy to end up in a gang. I mean, your own family, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, like I said, my mother's a drug addict. My brother was in gangs and cousin was in gangs. And that's because the generation before me was beaten by their dad, and my aunts and uncles were beaten by their dad. And for us, it was, you know, they all dropped out. You know, I was the first to graduate high school in my generation. And you know, one day my mother didn't come home. And a week later, she didn't come home. And And then days later, weeks later, she didn't come home. And I thought she was dead for sure. You know what I mean? And long story short, she checked into this recovery home. And she was there for 6 months. And I wouldn't go visit her. My brothers visit her. But for me, I was so bitter and so hateful towards her because of the jokes that everyone had at school about my mother. And so I took on that pain. And 6 months later, I decided to go visit her. And I remember walking into this church, and she was singing, glowing. And I was like, oh, I knew at that moment that I had forgiven her, that you know, the love I seen in her face was just different from anything I ever seen. But she grabbed the microphone, and she gave a testimony. And she said, you know, I had to do this for my kids, you know? I had to change my life for my kids. I was a drug addict. I was running the streets. And, you know, and she let it all go. And I think to fast forward back to when she told me the story from her grandfather, I think, you know, in my head, I always had these questions of like, why? And I blame her for everything, even when she came home for a little bit. And I think she told me that story about my grandfather, just letting me know her history. You know, and she was into breaking generational curses, that it ends here. You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the reasons why she told me that story. And that was the beginning of change for me, because that moment when she came home and she prayed every day, she got us up every morning to pray. And I was like, wow, this is different. This is so weird. But I seen things changing. You know, I seen her changing. And all of a sudden, you know, my uncle, who was a gang leader, changed. My other uncle, who was a drug addict, changed. My aunt changed. And no one's on drugs. You know what I mean? For me, that was the beginning of hope. And as I said in my book, I got rid of all my friends, went to a different school, and I read my first book, you know, The Count of Monte Cristo at 15 years old, you know, and I just fell in love with that. So there is hope, you know, there's hope. And that's the same hope that I'm bringing to these kids. And I was in Springfield, Massachusetts, not too long ago, an auditorium of 400 kids. And I kid you not, in the middle of speaking, kids were running out of the auditorium when I was talking about my mother. And then after the speech, they was all lined up in the hallway, and the teacher said, these are kids with a similar situation. Wow. And I sat there, and with tears in their eyes, I'm talking about guys that were 6'4", crying. You know what I mean? No one has ever, no teacher, no one has ever went to their school and openly said that this what takes place with my mother. This is how I survive. And the answer was, how do I survive? Like, your mother changed. Well, my mother, she don't have no recovery home. And I say to them that, okay, you be the hope. You find a community center. You find a church. And when they're ready, you're the light that they're going to run to. You be the person. You be the one. And, you know, and that was the same story that happened to me and the guys that were on the rowing team. We became the hope. We became the light because the kids on our team were drunk sons of drug addicts, prostitutes, gang leaders, and we became that hope.
Oh, we're going to get to rowing.
Because, again,
you know, this is just, it's not where you expect a story to go. I think it's going to be a great film. And we're talking to R.J. Cooper, whose memoir is Sugar Water. But, you know, I thought of your mom and that story. First of all, if I remember correctly, didn't you say that, you know, in that moment she tells you that you're 15? You didn't really know how to react. It wasn't a very emotionally giving family, or at least, right? So it wasn't like, I'm just going to go give her a hug.
No. We was not an affectionate family.
Okay. All right. So there's that. But here's what I thought of Arshe. I have mentioned that for years I was a local television news reporter. We spent a lot of time in the Hall of Justice, mm-hmm. covering trials, things like that. And one thing you see down there, if you're down there often, in an elevator, walk down the halls, you see a lot of African-American children, maybe 3-4 years old, sometimes with single moms, sometimes seeing a dad, sometimes with a grandmother, but they have this blank look in their face. Not all that unlike the way you described the way you saw people on drugs looking, mm-hmm. but these are kids, and I now probably understand that better as just a look of trauma, right? That mm-hmm. glazed over look of trauma. And I just remember over the years seeing those kids and thinking, their dad's here today for some offense, for some trial. And I know what people are saying about their dad. And if we're not careful, someday that will be them. But we won't try to contextualize the fact that they used to be that 3-year-old who didn't know why they were at the Hall of Justice. And when your mother was telling you that story at 15, it was similar in that she wanted you to know, life has been hard for us, but I want you to have a little context, and it may break you a little bit, but if we understand the context, we can help each other heal, as opposed to just judging that, oh, this person got picked up for this robbery, this person is down there for this, as opposed to, that's a human being.
Yeah.
What happened to lead to that point? Mm-hmm. And I thought of your mother, and I thought of those kids at the Hall of Justice.
Wow, that's powerful. And I think conversations started that. When I spoke to that school with the kid at beginning with children, afterwards, I walked away, walking the train to the subway, saying to myself, I'm so glad he was punching a desk instead of someone else's face.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I think it was right time. And it's just so important to get mentors and speakers in the classroom, you know, because the teachers have to teach, you know. They can't do that thing every day. And somehow I know teachers are social workers, security guards and everything, counselors in the classroom. And it's pretty rough on them. But I would say we need to get more mentors in those classrooms.
Talking to Arshay Cooper, by the way, more mentors who look like them?
Who look like them. You know, I think that's very important. I think that's important. And I've brung speakers in that don't look like them, but they relate with them in a sense of they was a football player or you know what I mean, or a basketball player. You know, I think if you can relate in some way, I think you have their attention.
Yeah, and so there was one thing that I was... I don't know if confused is the right word, but you talk about resenting your mom because of the way the kids made fun of you because she was on drugs, right? But you open the book by mentioning the fact that you got to know what the face of a drug addict looked like, this sort of this blank stare, the zombie, I think you called it the zombie.
The zombies, yeah.
The zombies. So you saw it all the time. So I'm thinking the kids were making fun of you. You cannot be the only one whose parent is on drugs, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because you saw it all the time, didn't you?
Yeah, I saw it all the time. And when I say the kids who were making fun of me, I mean, those are definitely kids whose parents were okay. You know what
okay.
I mean?
Okay, all right.
Those are the parents that were okay. And, you know, so, but there are parents that are on drugs, and you can't really tell, but there's a parent who are hardcore on drugs that's out there. You just see them, and they go Coop's mom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that was the difference, you know.
So before we get into rowing, which we're going to spend much of our second half hour with Arshay Cooper here, I just want to ask you about how you feel about the way Chicago's being discussed in the national media. I mean, we know that homicides are very high in Chicago. We know a high level of gun violence there. And, you know, a lot of people who are talking about it use it as a reference point for crime and violence, but probably having never been there. And I'm just, first of all, curious to know, you know, does it break your heart? Do you think is it valuable that at least we're talking about Chicago? Is it talked about without context? You know, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, you know, it hurts. You know, it's my city. I love my city. But, it's not just those inner cities. You know, how do you stay clean in a filthy environment when, all right, people are doing drugs? And not only that, that the leadership, that the politicians are going to jail, the politicians are getting locked up. And some police officers, those who are serving protecting, are getting prosecuted, and you know, and teachers are getting in trouble. So it's hard for a young person when you hear this every day on the news or from the person in the barbershop talking about it every day. It's in your ear, you know, and so it's everywhere in Chicago, and I hear about it every time, and it breaks my heart. And I do say this to people, that there are a group of people in Chicago. So many community centers, like what Ken Alpart did with our team. No one ever talks about that. You would have never heard of it until I told the story. There are people that are really doing good things in Chicago. Chicago's a big city, and there are people doing great things. And I think, you know, people are hungry, people are starving, people are stealing, it's tough, you know. And to attack that, I think we have to shine light on those who are doing a good job. We have to let people know there's a Victory Outreach, you know, that there's a Chicago Youth Rowing Club, you know. But again, no one is pointing, the media is not pointing us in that direction, because they are there in that community, you know what I mean? They are there, and people are doing great things, but no one knows. So when I come back to a school, I kind of do my research. Okay, what community center is here? What church is here? Blah, blah, blah. And I'll go to a school, and I was talking, I was like, here are the answers. These are the places you can go to. And people are like, oh, even teachers who teach in a neighborhood don't even know about these places. And so I think if we can offer hope instead of talking about the pain and sorrow, which happens in a lot of cities, I think things will get a little bit better. We can start there. You know what I mean?
Is it too easy to get guns?
I think it's really easy to get guns from people. You know, I don't know if you, on chapter six, I talk about how we were young and the cheapest toy was guns.
And that is crazy. And,
you know, we would get a water gun to shoot each other. Then we'd buy cap guns to play cops and robbers. And then the toys for Christmas would be the little green man with the army toys. And so we would get the super soakers and they would be big guns. Everything was guns, guns, guns. So when we was 14 and we got a BB gun, it was familiar. And then when someone makes you upset, then you get the real gun. It's familiar to your grip. It's not, there's no conviction because I've been playing with guns my whole life. So I'm not even scared to pull the trigger. I know how to pull the trigger. You know what I mean? I'm not even kidding, man. I would talk to kids on a block and they would say, so-and-so want this gun. He's selling this gun. His father have three guns. I know where to get it. Let's get it. Let's sell it. Or if you get pulled over sometimes, people will take your gun. Cops will take your gun, but you just, you never get in trouble for it. You know what I mean? We don't know where those guns are at, but that happened too. So it's pretty easy to get guns in Chicago. And, that's the story with guns, for me, I was always afraid of guns, it's easy, it's easy to get it.
And I'm not sure there's an easy fix for that either. I mean, because there's so many.
It's so many.
Yeah, there are so many. We're talking to Arshay Cooper, who's the author of Sugar Water, a memoir, but he is a lot more than that. He is, I don't know what you're... What do you put first on your resume, by the way? what's number one when you have to list your titles? What is it?
I think author.
Author's one.
Yeah, author's one.
What's two?
I say speaker.
Motivational speaker. Okay.
Yeah. Rower. Rower because, sometimes rower should be number one as a black man. Because I can talk about being a chef. I was a personal chef, a private chef. I can talk about being an author. But when you say you're a rower, I hear a lot of people say, well, what's that again? You was a rower? Even at sitting in a bar, when I say rower, people want to know the story. How? Why? How did that happen?
Arshay, in the last 2 weeks, I've had you and your story on rowing and Drew Lanham, who calls himself the Black Birder, as a conservationist. He said he was 40 before he met another Black Birder. He said people are always like, wait a second, you're a birder? You're a conservationist? And he says, yes, our African-American kids, especially in the city, have to know there's a lot more opportunity than you're currently dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And your dreams have to get bigger and wider. And I think that your book's going to do that. Let's get our only break of the hour and let's come back and let's talk about how rowing fits in. And when we come back, we'll also tell you about all of the events coming up, because if you're just joining us, Arshay Cooper is in Rochester for several days, a guest of the Youth Sports Foundation, the Genesee Waterway Center, the City of Rochester, the Rochester River School, and the Rochester River Foundation. He's here as part of the River Romance Festival this weekend, so a lot going on with him. Let's get that break and come right back with Arshay Cooper. Coming up in our second hour, let's talk about endorsements. Should news organizations still endorse political candidates? When they do, it's typically a newspaper that is doing the endorsing, and the Democrat and Chronicle still endorses candidates. There is supposed to be a separation between the editorial and news divisions. So we'll talk about why more than half of Americans think newspapers shouldn't do that anymore, and why the Democrat and Chronicle thinks there's still a public good there. That's next hour. It's a short break, and we're coming right back here. Oh, we're on right now. I said it's a short break. It's the shortest break in radio, isn't it? So short that I often trip on myself. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us on this Friday afternoon. You can get Sugar Water right now. Where, Arshay Cooper?
On Amazon, Barnes & Noble, online. You can go to Sugar Water website. You order from there.
It's a great cover, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I love that.
That cover is an artist painted us on the Lincoln Park Lagoon in 1998. And my coach still had that painting, and I took that painting and decided to put it in the book.
So Arshay's here, and he has some events that you should know about. If you are appreciating his story now and you want others to hear it, grab somebody and head out to the RIT Mosaic Center, 2:30 to 3:30 this afternoon. That's open to the public. He's going to be talking about diversity and related issues that we've been discussing here. Tonight, 6 to about 7:15, free, open to the public, his talk, Changing the Lives of Urban Youth Through Rowing. That's at the Adams Street Rec Center in Rochester, the Adam Street Rec Center. So that's tonight. And then he's on Sunday going to be at the Genesee Waterway Center near the race's finish line. You can see him under that big City of Rochester tent at Genesee Valley Park. And from about 9 a.m. to 2 before he has to head back down to New York. So 9 to 2. And again, on Sunday, you're going to be doing what?
I'm going to be doing some erg demonstrations, and we're going to look at some rowing together. I'm going to sign some books and hang out with hopefully a lot of youngsters.
I think you should. This is one of those books where you should pick up and read it no matter who you are, but especially if you want to inspire somebody about change and how change can happen. But sometimes it takes a little intervention, and sometimes it takes unexpected intervention.
Yep.
When's the first time you heard of rowing?
Like I was talking about earlier, the morning my mom told me the news about her father raping her, I walked into school very upset. I was sitting in class and got into some issues, some physical issues with someone because I was upset about the news I heard earlier. But I remember walking into the lunchroom and, and everyone was kind of doing a thing. And I looked to my left and I see a huge boat in the lunchroom. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is that? And behind it was a TV monitor. And I walked towards the TV monitor, and I seen a bunch of white people rowing. I was like, no. And I walked away. And until the coach, Jessica, grabbed me, and she said, hey, would you like to join the rowing team? I was like, no, not interested. And I sat in my seat, and I told my friend, I was like, I don't know why black people don't even swim over here. Why are they going to put us in the middle of Lake Michigan flying down the lake? And and so my friend told me, hey, I was thinking we should join the team. And I said, okay, well, if you hook me up with this girl, I'll join the team, you know? And that's kind of how it happened. But I remember the first day, no one showed up. But the second day, they said free pizza when you come to sign up for rowing. And tons of people showed up in the gym room. But this Jewish guy with curly hair on a Ken Alpart, holes in his shoes, and he was a millionaire, you know? And he walked in, and he opened his mouth and he talked about the sport, the opportunity to travel, to change your way of thinking, to meet people that don't look like us, to experience the water and the peace that's in the water, and just have a bunch of new opportunities and college visits. And at the end of that, he said, if you do this with me, you will succeed if you do this. And I knew I wanted something new. You know, and I looked at my friend and I said, how do I sign up? You know, and since that day, the moment I wrapped my hands around an erg, it changed my life. It changed my life, changed my world. And me and my brothers on the team, and we've been brothers since, you know, and I wrote a book about it, and now it's going to become a movie.
It's going to become a movie. How long did it take for you to feel comfortable in the erg?
Not the first day. It took a couple weeks, but it's a machine that, you don't have to be athletic. It doesn't matter how big you are. If you don't have good hand and feet coordination, it doesn't matter if you're strong or not strong. It's for everyone. You get on that machine and
well, it'll make you stronger.
Definitely make you stronger. And the sport's for everybody, and it took me a few weeks, and that erg machine became my therapist. At the same time, you see that boxers, when they're upset or they need to blow off some steam, they punch the bag. But for me and for my friends, it was the erg machine, you know, because when you're on that machine, you don't have time to think about anything else because it hurts, you know, and it works every body part. And so it became my therapist. And every time I had a bad day, I went on that machine and I blew off all my steam and I came out a new man feeling great. You know what I mean? And also, I feel, looking great at the same time. You know?
Yeah, that didn't hurt, right?
Yeah.
I think at one point in the book, you did say you had a curiosity about the kayak, but you kind of looked at the kayak as sort of the rich white people's thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to me, again, I connect that to the fact that, well, you could have felt that way about the erg from the beginning, right? The first time you saw the boat, they were all white kids that it didn't look like it was something that was for you.
Yeah.
Why do you think you were able to get over this idea that whether it's a kayak or other kinds of boat, that I can make, that can be for me? Because I think a lot of the concern would be a lot of students would feel like it's not for me.
You know, for me, it was the excitement, really. It's no magical answer to that. It was the other guys that just jumped on the machine. I don't know why they did it, but because they jumped on it, I jumped on it. honestly. You know, I knew I wanted to try it out, but the energy of other people doing it with you and say, let's do it together, that it helped me. I was just like, yeah, I'm gonna jump on that machine too, and I'm gonna do it. And that's how it started. And then, you know, I got on that machine because really that was the qualification in order to go to the Philadelphia trip. You know what I mean? He said, like, okay, if you do this, you go to these practices, you got to go to Philadelphia. And we haven't been anywhere, none of us. And I want to go to Philadelphia. I want to have, you know, do college visits and that stuff that I seen on the TV show, A Different World. I want to experience that. And, you know, and in order to do that, we had to get on that machine, and that was my way. And I got hooked, you know, and,
he told you would travel.
He said everything that man said, we did, you know. And the cool thing about it is that we haven't even gone downtown. We wouldn't even go downtown. We just stayed in our communities. And those boys in the boat that I rode with, who have never been anywhere, will all of a sudden start taking trips together. So when you see the title of my books, it's University of Pennsylvania, University of Wisconsin, Northwestern University. I wanted to show people, young people, that in this sport, you travel. You don't just race in your city. You travel with this sport. And in those bus rides, we talked about these cities. And everyone that's on the team, except for one person, live in a different state. It was exposed us as young at a young age. And we decided that we was going to move and try something new at that time. And we all did, you know, and we're still brothers. And, you know, and we talk about this story all the time.
Where do you think you'd be today if rowing never came into your life?
You know, my mom changed. So, you know, I figure I'd be local. And
but that was a huge change in your life.
That was a huge
rowing
change.
Rowing or not.
Yeah, rowing or not. That was a huge change in my life, her changing and reading and doing stuff local. But what rowing did for me is it expanded my mind, you know. Okay, crew team, you guys are going to go out and build the boathouse, but you're going to build it with St. Ignatius School. And so we're hanging out with people that don't look like us. And I was like, wow, these people are really cool. White people are really cool, you know. Hispanics are really cool, you know. And college visits. And one of the requirements was that we had to take entrepreneurship class every Tuesday and Thursday while being on the rowing team. And at that point, I learned a lot about just starting your own businesses and learning about, like, I am going to go to college. It's not an option. You know what I mean? I'm not just going to finish high school and just work somewhere. I'm going to go to college. You know what I mean? So rowing expanded my mind. You know what I mean? And it made me comfortable with the water. And I mean, one of the good things is that I never thought I'd learn how to swim or be comfortable with the water, you know? And so rowing did that for me and for everyone on my team.
You talk about someone who comes in with holes in their shoes, and yet you know they've got seven figures in a bank account. Which by the way, I think that's the real credible millionaires when they you can tell they're not flaunting in some way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when I think about your story, and I think about Rochester, for example, you know, sometimes it takes someone like that to come into the community and make sure the students know that there's a world outside what you've experienced.
Yeah.
You know, and you know that you knew there was from seeing A Different World on TV and Fresh Prince, but it was sort of abstract to you until somebody said, I can get you there, right? So I'm still concerned that in Rochester, there's students everywhere, really, but Rochester, that's where we are right now. I'm concerned that there are students growing up and they just, that's not even on their radar. What are the steps that are going to it's going to change that?
I think the steps really, hopefully this weekend, you know, this weekend is open to the public. You know, we start in Rochester, and then Joel's starting his school, with the river, you know, the Rochester Riverfront. You know what I mean?
We're going to talk about the River School.
River School, you know, and I think those are the steps. I believe that there are some opportunities. It may not be rowing, but a community center can take you places. You know what I mean? I know kids who didn't have rowing, who joined a community center, or who just went to the local barber and cleaned their hair there, and all of a sudden they're a barber. All of a sudden they have three salons or four salons. You know, and for me, without rowing, our school had a culinary program. And my culinary teacher said, okay, every Friday and Saturday, there's an opportunity to work at the Hilton Hotel, 16 years old, but you have to work for free. What? You know? But I did it. And Ken, my coach, said, do it. It's going to be the best thing for you. I decided to work for free in high school, you know?
You shouldn't have to, by the way.
I shouldn't have to.
But I take the point.
You know, yeah, I took the point. And
Ken is saying, this is an opportunity. This will open doors.
This will open doors for internship. And when I was after high school, when I graduated and I went to Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, I remember, and after Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, there's this really amazing French restaurant called Blackbird. And it won a James Beard Award. Chef Paul Kahn is one of the best in the world. And he looked at me, and there was a couple other guys who wanted to be in that restaurant. And he said, because of what you've done in high school is why I chose you to be here at 16 years old. That decision, that was tough from where you came from. You work for free. This is why you are here, you know? And so it paid off for me. You know what I mean? And I think what I'm saying is that I do believe that, you know, if mentors can push young people to those opportunities, even if it's not rowing, some of the opportunities are there. You know what I mean? And that's what I said in my book. Even if it starts at a barbershop, even if it starts in a restaurant, you know, if we can just do it, I believe that it can go somewhere, you know?
I'm talking to Arshe Cooper. And if you want to see more of his work, where can they find you online, Arshe?
www.arshecooper.com. You can find me on Sugar White or Arshe Cooper on Instagram, where I'm constantly posting stuff about what I'm doing, motivational speaking, where I'm at, sending quotes, and, you know, especially for high school students. I really cater to the high school students on my page. I love high school kids, and I want to put out more work and another book target towards high school kids.
Arshe is A-R-S-H-A-Y, Arshe Cooper. Mm-hmm. If you want to check him out there, what do you cook at home?
At home.
What do you cook when no one's around? And then what do you cook when you really want to impress a guest?
You know, I'm really into soups. You know what I mean? I do a lot, I did a vanilla infused squash soup a few weeks ago. I'm really into fancy stuff. Honestly, I'm into food art, so I kind of play around with food and I take pictures. And you know, it can be a filet. You know, it can just be Italian, but really, I'm into making food pretty, and sometimes I don't even eat it, but it's art for me. You know how some people sit around and draw? I like to, like,
you're
create
big,
plates.
Big presentation guy.
I love presentations, you know, but when it just comes to eating, I'm a grill, man. I love grilling steaks. I love making my own barbecue sauce. I'm really into barbecue. I'm really into Cajun food. But the school I went to was French, you know. I was like, oh, I may make a little money doing the French thing, but I don't make French food at home. You know, it's really just grilling steaks and, you know, meat and creating my own barbecue sauce and making soups and that kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the Rochester River School, which doesn't exist yet, and they're doing their best to raise money and get it going. And there's a lot of community support in certain quarters, but it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, as an aside, they won't be grilling that. Well, they'll be grilling. They'll be grilling eggplant, things like that. Be a vegan school.
Yeah.
Be a vegan school. But you brought up the River School because I know that you've had a chance to talk to the people who are involved with that effort. And do you think that if the River School happens in Rochester, even if it's a small handful of kids, does that spread? Does that mean if you have a friend who rows, are you more likely to row? If you have a friend who check something out that you didn't know was possible. You know what I mean? Like, because a lot of people say, well, that would be one school in a city that's got a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Why do you think the River School is a good idea?
You know, I think for me, it's always been just something different. You know what I mean? You know, and some people are like, I don't know if I want to be a part. You know, I think, first of all, I think everyone's kind of doing the same thing in the city. So we have a school that focuses on sailing or kayaking or rowing and just water sports and swimming. I think parents will say that's something different and want to get their kids into there. And if it's catching a buzz, I think other kids will go. I went to my high school because a few other friends went. I joined the rowing team because someone else said he was going to join the rowing team. And I think it depends on how well the school do and how well the kids like it, that it will happen if kids can somehow fall in love with it and they spread the word. I believe it will happen, you know. But I think because it's something new, it will draw kids to to the school. You know what I mean? And it depends. It depends on the people who go and tell their story and how the water changed their lives and the peace that you can find with water. You know, I always say, where I was at in the water, there was no police sirens, there was no gunshots. You know, it was just us, man. We enjoyed, like, we would row, and some people, you would be so exhausted from rowing, and you would see everyone go home. But for us, it was a place of refuge. It was an escape. So we would lay out on the boat, and the sun hitting our face. We don't get that in our community. You know what I mean? We have never seen that. So that was our peace. Our mother wasn't shouting down our ears, and people wasn't yelling. There was no zombies in the street, the drug addicts. And so we stayed there until we got kicked out sometimes. You know, that was our home, you know. And 20 years later, you know, somehow me and my friends are still talking about the same thing over and over again, you know. And we want to create the same thing. Roll Rochester want to create the same thing with the kids in Rochester. That same experience. And I was telling him, George, I already know, a high school in the city of New York, the principal bought 100 books. And these kids read it. And I went to the school just to do a Q&A with the kids. And these kids would not let me need. They said, now what? We want to experience what you experienced. Now what? Well, what are we going to do? And I was like, all right, I'm here every Tuesday and Thursday. And every Tuesday and Thursday I'm there. We own an ERG machine. I take them to Wall Street. We visit Ken's office. We drive over to Springfield, Massachusetts. We go to indoor races. And that's a commitment I made to those young people. And somehow they have they read about it, but never done it and fell in love with it. And have this, well, maybe only two kids dropped out of 25 in a matter of, what, 7-8 months. It, you know, new things change people. I want something new. You know, and I think that's why these programs will happen.
Arshay, we are in Monroe County, a pretty divided by race. You know, the country is pretty divided by race. Mm-hmm. In terms of geographically, we've made those choices. I mean, certainly Chicago, certainly our city now. How are you feeling about the state in general of relationships among cultures, among races in this country?
You know, I think the way I'm going to say this. I wrote this this line in a book where I was talking about Alvin's father who grew up in the South, and he did not want us to hang out with Ken because he was this white Jewish dude. I said, why is this white Jewish dude hanging out with you guys all the time? What's going on? And that's because of his experience growing up.
He was suspicious.
Yeah. And I said, that's his experience. But my experience is this, that there's been a black teacher that told me I was going to die before I was 18, and I've done nothing wrong. There was a white police officer who grabbed my book bag, walked home from school, emptied it out, and walked away. There was a white man who came and started this team and taught me everything he knew. There was a black man who gave me my first job and loved me. There are good people and there are bad people, those who are lost and those who are found, and those who are blind and those who can see. And so I say that because sometimes the way we grow up and our culture, our experience, like I said, I didn't think I can get along with people who didn't look like me. And that's just because the way I grew up and the stories I heard. But when I met these people, they were amazing, you know? And the same thing with Ken and those guys that raced for San Ignatian. They met us and it was amazing. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, we have to somehow learn about each other's history and accept that the fact that, you know, bad things happen in the past and get together and really talk about it. Get together, have a barbecue, watch Remember the Titans, and listen to some Bar Marley and hang out. That's the start.
Hey, who's going to star in the movie?
You know, we're working on that. Yeah, honestly, I'm going to tell you. I want.
You don't have to say anything to get yourself in trouble.
No, I'm not going to get myself in trouble. Okay. This is what I want. Okay. This is what I'm fighting for. Ken Alpart, who was our coach, he was this crazy white Jewish dude who does some crazy stuff. He would spend time on the west side of Chicago. I don't even want to spend time on the west side of Chicago. And he was comfortable there. And the things he's done, I was like, he reminds me of James Franco. You know? Yeah, he was that kind of guy. And for my mother, I don't know if you watch Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
So, Crazy Eyes. And I seen some YouTube videos of her just really serious. I would love for her to play my mother. I just, it's, some people don't understand it, but I see it. I see it in her eyes, the her role. I would love for her to play my mother. And for me, I haven't really figured it out yet.
Okay. All right. He's not ready to break it. We're out of time with Arshay Cooper, but his book is Sugar Water, a memoir. You can get it now at his website, Amazon, but get it from him and meet him if you want to meet him and continue bringing people in to see and hear his story. 2:30 to 3:30 at RIT's Mosaic Center this afternoon. Tonight, 6 to about 7:15, free and open to the public, he's giving a talk called Changing the Lives of Urban Youth Through Rowing. That's at the Adam Street Rec Center. And then on Sunday at the Genesee Waterway Center, 9 to 2 or so, helping people learn how to use rowing machines and sign copies of the book. It's great to have you in Rochester.
Thank you so much.
And I'm just honored to talk to you. I'm so impressed by everything that you've done.
Thank you.
Thanks for being
here. Yeah, I'll make sure, I'll send you a DVD or you got to go to the movies and watch it.
Right? It's coming in 2018?
2018.
That's Arshay Cooper. More Connections next.